Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, June 12th, 2022. Because there are fewer local articles in this week's editions of the newspaper, I'll be providing a mix of local and state articles, as well as a few local sports stories. Shannon Medical Center has new option to control chronic pain, by Dr. Judat Mahmoud and Dr. Benjamin Ashworth, published Tuesday, June 14th. Uncontrolled pain can be debilitating, impacting every aspect of a person's life, including family interaction, ability to work or enjoy hobbies, and even mental well-being. According to the National Institutes of Health, NIH, pain affects more Americans than diabetes, heart disease, and cancer combined. Pain is cited as the most common reason Americans access the healthcare system. It is a leading cause of disability, and it is a major contributor to healthcare costs. Common treatments for pain often come with limitations that don't appeal to many patients. Ongoing use of medication, including opioids. Destruction of nerve fibers, known as radiofrequency ablation. Invasive surgical procedures. Permanently implanted neurostimulation systems. The Shannon Interventional Pain Management Team now offers a new option to control chronic pain. The SPRINT Peripheral Nerve Stimulation System is a minimally invasive neurostimulation treatment that may offer pain relief to people who have been suffering with chronic pain in their back, shoulders, knees, or are experiencing other nerve-related pain. This breakthrough restorative treatment targets select nerves to reduce the pain you have lived with for far too long. The SPRINT system sends mild electrical pulses called peripheral nerve stimulation, or PNS, directly to the nerves, which may reduce pain signals and provide you with relief. You can perform most daily activities during the treatment. A tiny micro lead, not much larger than the size of a hair, is placed to stimulate the targeted nerve. A small device sends gentle pulses through the micro lead to stimulate the nerve. A simple handheld remote allows you to control the stimulation level to find a setting that works best for you. After 60 days, the micro lead is removed and treatment is complete. The treatment is drug-free and requires no permanent implant. Studies have shown a majority of patients have seen sustained pain relief following the treatment, even up to 6 months to a year afterward. Because it is a minimally invasive treatment option, it can be introduced early in the treatment continuum, and often earlier intervention leads to better outcomes. There is a huge unmet need for pain treatment options that do not depend on opioids or require permanent implants. With SPRINT PNS, we now have a minimally invasive and effective option to offer this large patient population. The SPRINT system is covered by Medicare. Many private insurance companies also provide coverage following prior authorization. For more information about SPRINT Peripheral Nerve Stimulator, please call Shannon Clinic Interventional Pain Management at 325-747-2247. Three new businesses set to open at San Angelo Plaza, by Rosanna Frere, published June 16th. Three new businesses are moving into the strip mall at 1819 Knickerbocker Road, which is the former home of Corona's formal wear. Smoothie King, Jason's Deli, and C&G Sporting Goods will be the first new occupants of the building after Corona closed after 50 years at the location in October 2020. Smoothie King announced it will open June 27th, while Jason's Deli is expected to open later this summer. No opening date has been announced for C&G Sporting Goods. New Omicron variants are powering another, but smaller COVID spike in Texas. The newest strains of Omicron appear to evade immunity from past COVID illnesses, a Houston Methodist doctor and researcher says. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published June 15th. Austin. The number of confirmed or probable new cases of COVID-19 in Texas has increased fourfold since May 1st, and the number of patients in hospitals across the state has nearly tripled, the latest figures from the Department of State Health Services show. The increases, while stark in terms of percentages, still leave the state well below the skyrocketing levels fueled by the fast-spreading Omicron variant that took hold during the holiday season and did not loosen its grip until March. Dr. Wesley Long, director of diagnostic microbiology at Houston Methodist Hospital, said the present spike is powered by two new variants known as Omicron BA4 and BA5 that appear to be adept at reinfecting people made sick by the first Omicron wave. The evidence we have seen from laboratory studies and other things is that the BA4 and BA5 variants are likely able to evade a lot of the immunity that people may have received from being infected by the first Omicron strains over the last 6 months or so, Long said. Genome sequencing by Houston Methodist shows that the two new variants account for about 21% of the active COVID-19 cases in Texas. That tracks the latest figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which on Tuesday said BA4 accounted for 8.3% of the nation's cases, and 13.3% were from BA5. That's nearly double the percentages from 1 week earlier. According to the Texas Department of State Health Services, the trend line showing the number of new COVID infections in the state and the number of COVID patients being treated in hospitals remained fairly flat between March 1st and May 1st. But the stable trajectories did not last. On March 1st, DSHS showed that just over 1,700 new infections were reported in Texas, and the statewide hospital count was 693. As of Tuesday, the number of confirmed or likely new cases in Texas approached 6,800, and 1,638 hospital beds in the state were occupied by COVID patients. When the Omicron wave crested in January, a daily average of 75,000 new confirmed or probable cases were reported, and more than 13,300 COVID patients required hospitalization. To date, more than 7 million COVID cases, including reinfections, have been reported in Texas, according to national data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Nearly 88,500 people in Texas have died from the virus, the nation's second highest total after California's near 91,800. Long said because of the near universal availability of COVID vaccines, along with medicines that were not yet developed at the pandemic's outset more than 2 years ago, the state's medical infrastructure is not as frayed as it was around this time in 2020. And, he said, new infections are likely higher because many people who are found positive through at-home testing are likely not reporting the findings to public health officials. Also, because vaccines have been shown to stave off serious illness in many cases, it's likely many with mild symptoms are unaware they've contracted the virus, Long said. With the summer season now in full swing, Long cautioned that the risk of COVID spread is likely to increase, especially because the variant is showing an ability to evade immunity. There's probably higher levels of community spread than we realize, he said. Long said he expects the upward trend in new cases to continue through the summer and perhaps beyond, even if more variants surface. There's an element of COVID fatigue, and we all wish that COVID was over and we didn't have to think about it, he said. But it's in everybody's best interest to take advantage of the vaccines and all the treatments and everything we have to stay out of the hospital and to try to stop the spread of this virus. Now, here are a couple of front page articles from the Standard Times, published Monday, June 13th. Summer heat could hurt your mental health. Reverse seasonal affective disorder is a real diagnosis. by Nicole Villalpando, Austin American Statesman. It's really hot outside. This summer, which is expected to bring historic levels of oppressive heat, might have an effect beyond typical heat worries, such as dehydration and heat stroke. It could affect people mentally, too. We often think of seasonal affective disorder, commonly known as SAD, as something that happens in winter in places like Seattle, which sees many rainy, dreary days, or New England, which experiences days of snow, leading to cabin fever. Reverse seasonal affective disorder is a real diagnosis that is felt by people in spring and summer, especially in warm weather areas. People with reverse seasonal affective disorder can have symptoms such as decreased appetite and insomnia. Sometimes they have depression, but other times they might experience mania. People with SAD in winter, on the other hand, have depression, not usually mania, and increased appetite, carbohydrate cravings, weight gain, and the desire to sleep all the time. Many theories have emerged about why the heat might disrupt mental health. A 2018 article in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health suggested that the same part of the body that is trying to regulate body temperature might also impact levels of dopamine and serotonin being released in the brain. It noted numerous studies over time that showed an increase in admissions to mental health hospitals during heat waves. Summer also comes with more daylight hours, which means our internal body clock can become dysregulated, not allowing us to fall asleep or get enough sleep for mental health. Allergies and air quality, think about all those ozone action days coming our way, also can play a part in spring and summer weather, causing physical and mental health issues. Anything that affects our physical health affects our mental health, said Karen Hicks, executive director of National Alliance on Mental Illness, Central Texas. Hicks herself has experienced that feeling of being trapped inside during the summer. Here are some things that can help if you're feeling mentally affected by this heat. Get outside when you can. That might mean early in the morning and later in the evening right now. Avoid going out in the heat of the day. Dehydration, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke can all affect mental health regulation. Stay active, even if you have to be inside. Maybe you exercise at the gym. Maybe you walk around an air-conditioned space like a large store, mall, or your house. Hours of inactivity can lead to that trapped feeling, restlessness, or depression. Give yourself something to do. Plan regular indoor activities such as exercise, volunteering, or a project you want to do. Constant boredom can start a mental health spiral. Get enough sleep. It might still be light outside at 9 p.m. and the sun might rise at 6 a.m. But if you need to be asleep at 9 p.m. or still be asleep at 6 a.m., try to stick to your normal sleep routine. Invest in shades, blinds, or blackout curtains if you are light sensitive. Create a daily routine. Summer for families can mean a free-for-all with schedules. Try to mimic the school year with regular wake-up times, regular bedtimes, regular meal times, and regular activities, both physical and mental. Without structure, kids can get anxious and they can get less sleep than they need. Create some consistency. For kids who are at a different camp each week, try to make the rest of their day the same. Breakfast, dinner time, bedtime. Continue to eat healthy, regular meals. No one wants to cook in the heat of the summer, but that doesn't mean constant snacking or takeout. Boost the vegetables, fruits, and lean proteins for good brain power foods. Maintain a connection. Lacking the structure of the school year can feel isolating for kids and parents. Schedule play dates for kids and adults, or phone a friend often. Take mental health breaks. If you're feeling overwhelmed, think about doing some yoga or meditation. Reach out for therapy. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, Central Texas, NAMICentralTX.org, has resources on where to find help, as well as its own classes and support groups. More mental health companies launched during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they aren't doing things the same way. New offerings include virtual sessions as well as therapy by text message. Check with your insurance carrier or your workplace employee assistance program about what is offered and which providers are accessible to you. Need immediate help? Go to NAMICentralTexas.org/crisis for resources or call 512-472-4357 in Travis County, 1-877-466-0660 in Hays County, or 1-800-841-1255 in Williamson, Bastrop, Caldwell, or Burnett counties, or text NAMI to 741741. Poll says 77% of Texas school workers don't want to be armed, by Rebecca Johnson, Austin American Statesman. About 77% of Texas school employees don't want to be armed on campus or to be expected to intercept a gunman, a recent survey by the Texas American Federation of Teachers found. The survey also found that 90% of school employees have worried about a shooting at their school, while 42% say the Uvalde attack might affect their decision to return to work in the fall. A week after the May 24th shooting killed 21 in a Uvalde Elementary School, Texas AFT, a statewide union with 66,000 members, including teachers, school employees, and retirees, surveyed 5,100 people over 6 days to gauge their opinions on gun violence and arming teachers. Respondents included K-12 teachers and school employees, higher education employees, parents, and community members. About 4,600 of those surveyed were school employees. I hear from our members every day. They want to know, are they going to make me tote a gun? And if they're going to require me to tote a gun, I can't continue to stay in this profession, Zeph Capo, president of Texas AFT, said Wednesday. So many of our members find it absolutely without merit that they would even come up with these solutions, he said. Matt Rinaldi, chairman of the Texas Republican Party, saw the results differently, noting that almost 1 in 4 agreed when asked if they wanted to be armed. This number is several times greater than the number of people in the general population who carry, he said on Twitter, adding that the result warrants a far different discussion than the union sought. According to the survey, 99% of Texas school employees support comprehensive background checks before all firearm purchases, and 83% support a ban on assault-style weapons. It also reported that 96% of school employees support raising the minimum age for legal gun purchases to 21. 82% favor increasing secure storage laws, and 98% support red flag laws that would allow guns to be temporarily removed from those undergoing extreme emotional or mental health issues. Katrina Rasmussen, a high school teacher in the Dallas district and the mother of 2 middle school children, said she believes gun violence in classrooms is the most important issue in education today. She said classrooms have become war zones, while all she hears from policymakers is empty rhetoric. When I heard about Uvalde, I had just picked up my own kids from middle school and gotten home after a long day of testing and end-of-year celebrations on my campus. I felt like the floor had fallen out from underneath me, she said. These precious babies and their teachers were slaughtered. They were murdered in a place that should have been safe for them at a time that should have been full of joy and celebration. Rasmussen said she vehemently disagrees with arming teachers and doesn't think teachers would be able to store a gun safely in the classroom. If our interventions hinge on a teacher gunning down an armed intruder from within the classroom, we have already failed, she said. Texas Republicans have opted for a different approach. Shortly after the shooting in Uvalde, State Attorney General Ken Paxton said on Fox News that he believes more school staff should be trained and armed with weapons. At the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Houston at the end of May, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, said gun bans do not work, and what stops armed bad guys is armed good guys. Texas AFT decried Cruz's response, and some members marched to his downtown Austin office last week to demand that he support sensible gun regulation. Governor Greg Abbott also urged more school districts to increase the number of security officers and school marshals, a program that allows school employees to carry guns on campus after completing an 80-hour training and psychological exam. Only 84 school districts out of more than 1,200 have armed school staff. Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, said Cruz and Abbott are out of step with their constituents' views on gun policies. He called for laws that promote gun safety. "We need to do something, and that's the import of this survey," Weingarten said. "Texans are saying, let's focus on saving lives, not what the gun manufacturers want." Family raising money for funeral of San Angelo boy, 3, who drowned in apartment pool. By Rosanna Frere, published June 13th. The family of Rodolfo Mercado IV is raising money for funeral costs after the 3-year-old drowned in an apartment complex pool Thursday, June 9th. San Angelo Police Department officers were dispatched to the resort at Riverside, 3306 North Bryant Boulevard, about 5:27 p.m. Thursday for a possible drowning, according to a statement released by SAPD. Officers found the child and immediately began to administer CPR. He was transported to Shannon Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. SAPD's Crimes Against Children Unit and Crime Scene Investigation Unit arrived on scene to assist with the investigation. This incident is still under investigation, and further information will be released, according to SAPD's statement. A visitation for Rodolfo will be held Thursday, June 16th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Gutierrez Funeral Chapels, 1002 North Oak Street. The service will begin at 2 p.m., followed by the interment at 3 p.m. at Calvary Catholic Cemetery, 1501 West Avenue Inn. "Baby Rudy was full of life and joy," his obituary stated. "He was tiny and fearless, with a smile and dimples that nobody could stay mad at." Surviving are his parents, Jasmine Gonzalez and Rodolfo Mercado III, 3 sisters, Vanessa, Maricela, and Isabella, maternal grandmother, Patricia Mariscal, maternal grandfather, Jose Martinez, paternal grandmother, Bertha Mercado, paternal grandfather, Rodolfo Mercado Jr., and multiple aunts, uncles, and cousins. His aunt, Patricia Mariscal Yanez, started a GoFundMe account for the family. "Jasmine will be using the funds for his funeral expenses and any other expenses needed during this grieving process," the page stated. "Anything will help," she said. "Thank you, and please, above all, pray for them." American Plains Art Show to open at Fort Concho on June 23rd. From staff reports, published June 12th. Longhorns and sheep, cowboys and Indians, rustlers and bandits, thunderstorms and sunsets, mountains, deserts, and the Great Plains. It's all part of the 37th annual American Plains Artist Juried Exhibit and Sale at Fort Concho, set to open at the Fort's Quartermaster Galleries with a reception on Thursday, June 23rd, 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Refreshments and entertainment will be provided by Dorothy Douthit and Fiddle Fire Catering. Members of the Concho Cowboy Company will drop by in their late 1800s attire. The opening is free to all, located at the Fort's far northeast corner near Burgess Street and East Avenue C. This year's show features 76 paintings and some sculptures by more than 50 artists from across the nation. All art is for sale, with a percentage of each sale benefiting the artist, the American Plains Artist Association, and Fort Concho. Any purchased work remains on display until the show closes Sunday, August 7th. Regular hours will be Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and Sundays from 1:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. The show is free to all. Guests can vote for their favorite work. Those receiving the most votes are invited back for a special summer show at the Fort in 2023. Founded in 1982, the American Plains Artist Association is dedicated to highlighting the diversity of the American Plains through art. The APA has members across the nation whose efforts in both painting and sculpture cover the vast expanses of the plains through images of the landscape, the life, the people, and the wildlife. The organization sponsors two shows each year, in addition to workshops, scholarships, demonstrations, and lectures. According to APA President Judy McElroy, "We love coming to San Angelo and Fort Concho each summer. West Texans enjoy the scenes and themes our members take joy in painting and sculpting." Fort Concho site manager Bob Luthart noted how appropriate it is to host the group in San Angelo and to hold the show in the site's quartermaster galleries. "Over 35 years ago, some visionary citizens created the San Angelo Museum of Fine Arts and renovated the quartermaster building as its first home," Luthart said. "While the art museum has had its signature facility on the river since 1999, we like to keep the Western artistic traditions alive in the building that is so well suited for this type of show." Luthart pointed out that the Fort has a long history of promoting the regional and national Western heritage through many means, such as art, music, living history, period sports, exhibits, and lectures. Diane Bays, vice president of Discover San Angelo, pointed out that this exhibit supports San Angelo's recent recognitions as a True West Magazine number one Western town and the visual arts capital of Texas. In addition to the regular exhibit hours, the Fort will celebrate National Cowboy Day on Saturday, July 23rd with a light breakfast, special talks on the exhibit, and a performance by the Concho Cowboys, all from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. that day. For more information, visit AmericanPlainsArtists.com, FortConcho.com, or call the Fort at 325-481-2646. Christoval's Beth McCann turns love of acting into college scholarship, by Amy McDaniel, published June 10th. Christoval. Since she was 6 years old, Christoval High School's Beth McCann has loved acting. A dozen years later, the 2022 class salutatorian has earned a theater scholarship along with an academic scholarship to attend West Texas A&M University in Canyon. McCann was named Performer of the Year in Class 2A one-act play in 2021 when she helped Christoval win the state title, and she was part of the school's runner-up state finish this year while earning all-star cast honors. Now she'll continue her acting career at the next level, and that's a good thing because McCann doesn't think she could ever stop. "It was failure that made McCann realize she couldn't imagine life without theater. I think it was freshman year, but I knew I wanted to do this for the rest of my life, or at least try to do this, because we lost at area," McCann said. "Losing hits hard, and we were all a sobbing mess. Even the manliest man there was just a sobbing mess." While comforting each other over the end of a season, McCann thought, "This is theater. This is the community. Just to see the love for the stage, not the love for the winning." Theater helps Christoval shine in Lone Star Cup. McCann said she doesn't love theater for the competition, but she has helped her schoolmates rise to a position as one of the top-notch competitive schools in the state in terms of success in extracurricular activities. Christoval is currently in fifth place in the UIL Lone Star Cup standings for the 2021-2022 school year, with a final update due June 17th. If Christoval stays in the top five, it will be the school's highest finish in the statewide competition, which is based on team performances in athletic and academic competitions. Christoval one-act play and the theater program has contributed about a fourth of the total points the school has accumulated in cup competition the last 2 years. The state championship in 2021 brought 12 points toward Cristobal's total of 41 for a 10th place finish. The runner-up finish in 2022 was worth 10 points toward Cristobal's current total of 39. Cristobal High School principal John Choate, who admits he's pretty competitive when it comes to thinking about the Lone Star Cup, said it has become a mark of quality for Texas public school districts. For the longest time, it wasn't a conversation, said Choate, who pointed to other West Texas schools, Wall and Mason, who have won the Lone Star Cup in recent years. But once we appeared in the standings, yeah, we talked about it. We don't really talk in terms of the Lone Star Cup, but we talk in terms of, are all our programs successful? While Cristobal's athletic programs have done their part to score cup points, the theater program, led by Travis Harris, is one of the most consistently successful Cristobal endeavors. In his 10 years at Cristobal, the Angelo State University graduate, affectionately known as Mr. T, has sent plays to state competition 6 times. The Cougar Actors won state titles twice and finished second twice. McCann is the second Cristobal player under Harris's direction to receive the coveted Samuel French Award given to the state's best actor. McCann's success due to dedication. Harris said it would be hard to find a more talented, dedicated, hardworking performer than McCann, who earned the Mercer Theater Scholars Scholarship at West Texas A&M, along with an academic merit scholarship. In 3 seasons of one-act play, McCann has won Best Performer 5 times and All-Star Cast 4 times at various competitions. She's actually never had the lead, starring role, but she still managed to be the outstanding actress in the plays because she's that good, said Harris, who started working with McCann in 7th grade one-act play. She was definitely unique. She stood out. Harris said McCann's talent often forced her into supporting roles because they were more difficult, but his top actress never relied on her talent. She always is the one who knows what needs to be done to prepare for a production, the director said. She'll come in and work on something or paint something. She has left her mark, and everyone looks up to her. Last year, while portraying Margaret Berry in The Lost Boy, a play about Peter Pan author J.M. Barrie, Harris said McCann didn't have the most lines. She wasn't in every scene, but her acting ability made her stand out. She embodied that role like she always does. I tell students to read their scripts every day, and I know she is one that does, and she digs deep into her character and finds unexpected things. Harris said for her senior year, McCann was set to play the lead in Of Serpents and Sea Spray. But nobody was feeling it, McCann said. Harris went to his top student and suggested they instead perform the play that was scrapped in 2020. But the lead in Unexpected Tenderness is a male character. I knew for anybody it would be heartbreaking, but she still stood up for the team, Harris said. I remember her words, whatever I need to do. But I could tell it wasn't what she wanted to do. Summer program led to eventual scholarship. Since the age of 6, when her parents signed her up for a San Angelo Broadway Academy, SABA, summer program, I think they were just trying to get me out of the house because I was a little devil child, McCann said. She has loved the stage and simply being involved. I got one line in 6 years there, but I just loved being on stage, said McCann, who was thrilled when she discovered she could participate in one-act play in junior high. I'm doing theater. I don't care what part I get as long as I'm on stage. SABA was McCann's path to the stage, but it took younger brother Benjamin a little longer to follow. The funny thing is, Ben has the absolute worst stage fright, or he did, McCann said of her brother, who was part of both the 2021 and 2022 Cristobal OAP productions. I kept trying him to come to SABA with me. I was like, Ben, you'll love it. You'll have so much fun getting into costume and makeup. They'll give you a mustache. I was trying so hard to get him in, but he just couldn't because he had such stage fright. When Ben, who will be a junior next year at Cristobal, was in seventh grade, his sister finally talked him into participating. But he just wanted to be crew, McCann said. Still, Harris requires even crew to perform a monologue for auditions. He knocked it out of the park, and he was cast as Templeton in Charlotte's Web, McCann said of her brother's audition. Ironically, Ben has played the son of his sister's characters in two productions. Looking to the future. McCann said she can't imagine a life without performing, but she's also interested in the production side of theater. Having competed in UIL theatrical design competition at State and always having an interest in art, McCann will double major at West Texas A&M, adding graphic design to her repertoire. So I was just going to go to WT for their graphic design program, McCann said. They have some really successful graduates who went on to work for Marvel. While competing at Regional, hosted by West Texas A&M, she caught the eye of the theater directors. I want theater to be a part of my life, even if it's just community theater. I will never give up on that, McCann said. But ever since I was little, I wanted to work as a character designer for a video game company or Pixar. I'm just going to follow along those two paths and see where it takes me. Records release detail what led to sudden resignation of Angelo State University president. By Elena Edgen, Lubbock Avalanche Journal, published June 8th. In less than a 24-hour period before a Texas university president resigned in 2020, an employee reported multiple sexual harassments in the workplace and claimed she was retaliated against, according to university records released on Tuesday. Brian May served as the president of Angelo State University, part of the Texas Tech University system, for 8 years. He was well known throughout the San Angelo area, attended events with city and state officials, and previously served as the color commentator for nearby Wall High School's football games. His sudden resignation on April 10, 2020 shocked the community, even more so when no reason was given. The San Angelo Standard-Times reached out to ASU, Texas Tech, and the U.S. Department of Education in search for a reason. At 4:19 p.m., Tuesday, June 7, 2022, an official with Texas Tech released several records, including a document detailing the actions hours before the resignation. Texas Tech System releases record of retaliation after sexual harassment reported. At 5:46 p.m., April 8, 2020, an Angelo State University employee reached out to the Texas Tech Administration Office of Equal Opportunity. The employee's claim detailed multiple instances of alleged verbal and physical sexual advances, which included kissing and sexual touching on several occasions in the workplace, according to a summary of the investigation. On April 10, 2020, the office's assistant vice chancellor met with Chancellor Ted L. Mitchell over Skype and alerted him to the investigation. Chancellor Mitchell was tasked with informing May and immediately started driving to San Angelo. He texted May at 1:37 p.m. about wanting to meet. After receiving 20 calls and 3 texts from May before 2:03 p.m., Mitchell stopped driving and called him. Mitchell told May a complaint of sexual misconduct had been filed against him by the employee. May was told of the investigation procedure and told not to contact the employee. Nearly 30 minutes later, May started attempting to contact her. Between 2:32 p.m. and 3:28 p.m., May attempted to call the employee 20 times, 17 of which went unanswered. He also texted her at 2:32 p.m., asking that she call him regarding a work matter. In one of the calls, he told the complainant she needed to recant and tell the Office of Equal Opportunity that the matters did not happen. He gave the employee the assistant vice chancellor's private cell phone number and told her not to let the office know he called her. He texted her again at 3:24 p.m., asking for her to call him again, but she did not. The employee blocked his number. Later that evening, May resigned before the office could complete its investigation. Nevertheless, even without completing the original investigation or making a finding of whether May's actions constituted sexual harassment or other prohibited activity, we found that by contacting the complainant after being instructed not to and telling her to recant and withdraw her complaint, his actions constituted interference with an investigation and retaliation and are thereby in violation, the report stated. Hours after his resignation, Chancellor Mitchell sent May a letter at 9:13 p.m. I ask that you make arrangements to move out of the president's residence and return any ASU property leased or loaned to you as soon as possible, he stated in the letter. What happened next? Fight for information leads to court and Texas Attorney General's ruling. In July 2021, the San Angelo Standard-Times began the process to file open records requests with ASU, Texas Tech, the U.S. Department of Education. These documents asked for Title IX complaints against May filed during his presidency. In November 2021, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton ruled the records should be released. In a response from May's legal team, they argued these records should not be given as May was now a private citizen. May's legal team filed a temporary and permanent injunction against Texas Tech and the Attorney General's office. This could have sealed the records from the public's view. As the new year began, the Standard Times' legal department, through USA Today, filed motions to dissolve the injunction. The latest motion was heard in Austin on Tuesday, May 26, 2022. Nearly a year after the initial requests, May dropped the injunction lawsuit on June 3rd, opening the way for the records to be released. Lawmakers urge DPS to give more Uvalde shooting information in Spanish, by Eric Nugborn, Texas Tribune. Two congressional Democrats from Texas are calling on the State Department of Public Safety to provide more Spanish language communication and updates about the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, a predominantly Hispanic community. Representatives Joaquin Castro, Democrat San Antonio, and Veronica Escobar, Democrat El Paso, said in a letter to DPS that the high number of Spanish speakers in Uvalde necessitates more Spanish communication from DPS officials. Democratic Representatives Norma Torres of California, Chuy Garcia of Illinois, and Raul Gravulia of Arizona also signed the letter. It is unconscionable that public safety officials are neglecting to provide critical information in Spanish to a predominantly Spanish-speaking community, the representative said in a letter to DPS Director Stephen McGraw. As investigations continue, all Uvalde residents deserve to know the full details of this horrifying tragedy. DPS has come under fire for its lack of Spanish communication in the aftermath of the shooting in which 21 people were killed last month. More than 80% of Uvalde's population is Hispanic or Latino, and more than half of the households in Uvalde speak Spanish, according to census estimates. Less than 10% of households in Uvalde speak limited English. Steve McGraw is from El Paso, Escobar said in an interview. He should know better. In a press conference 2 days after the shooting, DPS officials ignored calls from reporters to answer questions in Spanish. Journalists reporting from Uvalde have also said officials did not provide information in Spanish after previously promising to do so. The people of Uvalde cannot be ignored, and they deserve answers in their preferred languages, the letter said. DPS did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Abbott said police quickly killed Uvalde gunman. Then he was misled. Here are his quotes. By Caroline Chisolfi, Austin American Statesman, published June 14th. Governor Greg Abbott's handwritten notes, taken as law enforcement officers briefed him on the Uvalde school shooting a day after the massacre, do not include mention of police rushing to kill the shooter and save lives. The picture of police heroism he painted in a news conference shortly after the briefing. Much of Abbott's May 25th remarks closely mirror the 9 pages of notes obtained by the Austin American-Statesman through the Texas Public Information Act. But the governor appeared to veer from his script during his opening comments when he depicted law enforcement's response as prompt and resolute. They showed amazing courage by running toward gunfire for the singular purpose of trying to save lives, he said at a news conference that was broadcast on national cable news networks and streamed online. And it is a fact that because of their quick response, getting on the scene, being able to respond to the gunman and eliminate the gunman, they were able to save lives, Abbott continued, stressing the word fact. But his notes do not make specific time references or mention the pace at which the events on May 24th unfolded. They say that law enforcement engaged the shooter and that officers from multiple agencies converged on the classroom, that 3 officers were wounded, and that a Border Patrol agent fired the fatal shot at the gunman. Timeline of police response to Uvalde shooting. A timeline provided by Texas Department of Public Safety officials 2 days later revealed that officers waited more than 70 minutes before confronting the gunman and killing him, even as children inside the classroom where the gunman was barricaded were frantically calling 911. 19 children and 2 teachers were killed in the rampage, and it's not clear how many lives might have been saved had the police swiftly stopped the shooter when they first arrived at Robb Elementary School. The governor later defended his statements by claiming he merely repeated what he was told, and he said he was livid about being misled. I wrote down hand notes in detail about what everybody in that room told me in sequential order about what happened. And when I came out here on this stage and told the public what happened, it was a recitation of what people in that room told me, Abbott said 2 days after his initial Uvalde news conference. After his opening words framing the incident response as a model of police heroism, he closely followed his notes, saying many details surrounding the shooting were yet to be determined as part of an ongoing investigation. What did Governor Greg Abbott's notes on Uvalde shooting say? The notes, barely legible in places, provide a glimpse into the governor's initial understanding of how Texas's worst school shooting unfolded. The primary speaker, believed to be a DPS officer, but not revealed in the notes, recounted the broad outlines of the gunman's movements and the police response, but omitted a key piece of information that is now the subject of state and federal investigations. Dozens of officers waited more than an hour inside a school hallway and outside the building, apparently held back by the incident commander, Uvalde School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo. DPS Director Steve McGraw later said that Arredondo wrongly believed no more lives were in danger and was treating the situation as a barricaded person and not an active shooter. The notes recount that the gunman shot his grandmother in the face, who then called police. The gunman then drove to the school, crashing his pickup nearby. A school resource officer approached gunman and engaged as the gunman entered the school. Another key detail that officers later said was wrong. A resource officer was not on campus and arrived as the gunman was outside the school but didn't see him, officials later said. Gunman entered back door and went down 2 short hallways and into a classroom on the left, the notes read. The classroom was connected to another classroom. Border Patrol, ISD officers, police, sheriffs, and DPS converged on classroom. BP officers killed the gunman. It's not clear if the officer giving the briefing was aware of the delayed response in confronting the shooter. In a statement Tuesday, Abbott spokeswoman Renee Ease said, as the governor has said, the information he originally shared was provided during a briefing by a room full of public officials. The investigations being conducted by the Texas Rangers and the FBI are ongoing, and we look forward to the full results being shared with the victims' families and the public, who deserve the full truth of what happened that tragic day. American Statesman staff writer Tony Plotsky contributed to this report. ASU's World Series run ends with loss to Westchester by Paul Harris, published June 8th. The Angelo State University baseball team season ended Wednesday with a 12-2 loss to Westchester in the NCAA Division II College World Series in Cary, North Carolina. It was the second consecutive blowout loss for the Rams, who were still reeling from an 18-3 setback against North Greenville the previous day. ASU finished its season with a record of 51-14. The Rams entered the World Series with the number one ranked offense in the country, averaging an incredible 10.7 runs per game. However, that masked the fact ASU was allowing just over 5 runs per game. In all 3 of their World Series games, the Rams allowed 4 or more runs before they made it through the second inning. The offense, and a remarkable relief pitching performance by Kyle Mosley, allowed the Rams to rally for a 7-4 win over Southern New Hampshire in their opening game. Yet their final 2 games seemed over almost before they began, as ASU trailed 10-0 by the 4th inning each time. Westchester jumped out to a 4-0 lead in the top of the 1st on 2-run blasts by Justin Horn and Keith Flaherty. The Golden Rams added 6 more runs in the 4th, on only 3 singles and a double, as the Rams did much of the damage to themselves with 3 walks, 3 wild pitches, and a passed ball. ASU's offense scattered 10 hits, led by freshman Austin Beck's 3-for-5 game. He singled in Tripp Clark in the 9th inning for his 60th RBI and the Rams' final run. Clark singled in Austin Williams in the 4th inning for ASU's other run. Clark and Thomas Kane each went 2-for-4 at the plate. ASU was making its 2nd consecutive appearance and 5th overall at the College World Series since the Rams revived their baseball program in 2005. Westchester, 35-13, moves on to the semifinals against North Greenville in a matchup the Golden Rams will have to win twice. Point Loma will play Rollins in the other semifinal. Point Loma needs only 1 win to advance to the championship, while Rollins has to win twice. San Angelo Central's Widener Lagunas earn first team honors on 2-6A baseball team by Charles Bryce, published June 12th. San Angelo Central High School senior pitchers Hunter Widener and Juan Diego Lagunas earned first team honors on the district 2-6A baseball team. Second team honorees included senior pitcher Ethan Green, senior outfielder Trayton Snelson, and senior outfielder Ty Casey. 2 Bobcats received honorable mentions, senior second baseman Caden Box and senior first baseman Stryler Price. Central finished 11-21 overall and 9-9 in district to place 4th. The Bobcats were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs. Midland Legacy senior Chase Shores was named the MVP. Friendship junior Rylan Morin was the pitcher of the year, and Odessa Permian senior Xavier Melendez was the offensive player of the year. Permian senior Peyton Gregory was selected as the defensive player of the year. Friendship sophomore Hudson Hutchison was the newcomer of the year. Lakeview's Wyatt Henry, Obregon, earned first team honors on 3-4A baseball team by Charles Bryce, published June 12th. Lakeview High School senior infielder Oscar Obregon and sophomore outfielder Wyatt Henry earned first team honors on the district 3-4A baseball team. Second team honorees for the Chiefs include senior pitcher Cade Henry, senior catcher J.D. Salgado, senior outfielder Jason Chakub, junior outfielder Joseph Coffran, and junior designated hitter Gary Cruz. Lakeview finished 11-14 overall and 5-10 in district. The Chiefs missed making the playoffs by 1 spot. Leveland junior Joel Pena was selected as the MVP. Offensive MVP honors went to Big Spring senior Joshua Miramontes, and the defensive MVP is Snyder senior Bryce Ford. Snyder sophomore Brant House was Pitcher of the Year, and Big Spring freshman Austin Raines was the Newcomer of the Year. Ballinger's Jenna Battle claims All-Star West Texas Softball MVP Award again, by Amy McDaniel, published June 8th. When first-year head coach Kenzie Willis called senior Jenna Battle the cornerstone of Ballinger softball, it was a fitting description of the role the catcher played for the Lady Cats in 2022. Breaking in a new coach and three freshmen in the starting lineup, Battle glued it all together for Ballinger, and in doing so, earned All West Texas Most Valuable Player honors a second time. "She is so much more than her numbers," Willis said. "Those speak for themselves, but she's really just a true leader. She's a go-getter. She wants to be the best at everything and in the best way. She's a great leader, a great teammate. She'll do whatever you ask her to do, and a lot of our success is because of that." To be fair, the catcher on any team is often a coach on the field, and Battle has been playing that role since the middle of her freshman year. As a senior, the pressure would be amped with a new head coach and freshman in three infield positions as the Lady Cats fought for a playoff spot against a stacked District 6-3A. In leading her team to a third-place finish behind Merkel and Clyde, Battle earned offensive MVP honors for a second straight year. The Lady Cats stomped Stanton 21-5 and 15-5 in a Class 3A by district series before falling to Jacksboro 5-4 and 4-1 in the area round. With a strong junior class and the core of the infield returning, Willis anticipates continued success for the Ballinger program, but she'll look back at how Battle made the transition so easy. "That was one of the things that stood out to me the most," Willis said. "Whenever you've been the foundation of the program and were the MVP last year and had done all these things, it's hard to adjust to a new coach and do things differently, just because what you had been doing worked. But Battle did everything I asked and really helped the transition. If we didn't have Jenna, it wouldn't have gone as well." Coming together as a team was so important to Battle. She finds it difficult to talk about individual accomplishments without using the pronoun we. "I expected for myself to hit home runs. My goal was to hit four home runs," said Battle, who hit eight long balls for the season. "To have fun as a team and to get the team going was my personal goal because I knew I couldn't do it by myself." Battle also had three triples, nine doubles, and drove in 26 runs while hitting at an average of .458. She had an on-base percentage of .567 and stole 16 bases. She was a known commodity, but still got the job done, the coach said. "She saw a lot of change-ups, everything they had to throw her off, and it didn't," Willis said. Her seventh-inning home run that tied the game against then-number 13 Clyde to set up Ballinger's eventual win was a turning point in the season. Tristan Holscher followed two batters later with a home run to win the game. "That to me was the point where we knew we were going to compete, go to the playoffs, and be successful," Willis said. "One of the big things we talked about all year long was to put the ball in play and make other people make mistakes, to minimize strikeouts and put the ball in play, and she did that." It was perhaps Battle's play in the field and her experience that had the most effect on the season. Catching 130 innings, she had a .950 fielding percentage with just six passed balls. She threw out nine steal attempts. "We had a close game against Wall. We were battling for third and fourth place, and it was a one-run game. And they tried to steal, and Jenna threw her out," Willis said. "It was a turning point in the game, and it certainly was a momentum changer for us." Those big moments were provided by some early physical and psychological work on the part of the coach and catcher. "Coach Willis was all about hustle," Battle explained. "If we didn't hustle, we ran. If we didn't dive for a play, we ran. We ran a bunch." Battle said that was a good strategy for molding young and experienced teammates into a cohesive unit, and Willis relied on Battle to lead the way. They have all played together for way more years than in high school, and you can tell by the way she carries herself, the way everyone responds to her, that they trust her, the coach said. They know she's a leader because she does such a good job of doing what she's supposed to do. She makes following her easy. One freshman starter was Battle's sister, Jessa, who is the All-West Texas Newcomer of the Year after earning first-team All-District honors behind a .405 batting average and 17 RBIs, along with a .250 ERA in the circle. But Battle didn't treat her sister any better or worse than any other lady cat, said Willis, who had a third All-West Texas honoree in junior staff ace Alina Pena. They all responded really well, Willis said. Battle said it was obvious the freshmen were timid to start, but quickly realized, I'm on varsity now, I've got to pick it up. And a lot of them flipped the switch. It was time to buckle down, put my big girl pants on, and play softball. An early loss to Jim Ned reminded Battle of her freshman year, when she started the season at shortstop before taking over for an injured senior behind the plate. I was not comfortable at all, and I had been in their shoes. So just like the older players did for me when I was a freshman, I told them, there will be other opportunities for you to make a play. Battle's influence on the Ballinger program will persist, Willis predicts. The eldest Battle girl will move on to her educational goals at Texas Tech University, though she hopes to participate in intramurals. But in addition to Jessa, Willis can look forward to the littlest Battle, Jolie, who will be an eighth grader next year. Jenna will leave some very, very big shoes to fill, but we've got a couple more Battles to go.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.